Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We do not have a quorum at this time, so I'll wait to call this meeting to order, but I would like to get started with the DPS presentation. So I don't know who's going to be our... there they are. Good to see you this afternoon. Come on forward, and when you're ready, is your technology working today?
Yes.
That's a good thing. I like that. When you're ready, go ahead and introduce yourselves for the record and go ahead with the presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, and good afternoon, members. For the record, my name is Mona Doman. I'm the Commissioner of Public Safety, and Deputy Commissioner Cassandra O'Hearn is with me today, and we're going to give the governor's budget proposals and a little bit of an overview. And so we appreciate the time that you are taking today. We understand you have a busy agenda, and so we will work through this to give you the information and certainly answer any questions that you have.
Well, thank you, Commissioner. I'm glad you're here. You may have noted kind of the mood around here is shifting a little bit as we approach deadlines, so I appreciate your expediency in getting through the presentation because we do have some bills up later in the day. So go ahead.
I understand that, Mr. Chair, and you're welcome. The Department of Public Safety is a diverse agency of 10 divisions. Our overarching mission is to keep the people of Minnesota safe. We know that people have real concerns about public safety. We hear it every day as we travel around the state doing our work. The majority of our work at the department is directly supports local agencies and the communities that the public safety professionals work within. Our divisions investigate complex crimes. They investigate fires. They patrol our roads and highways. They issue driver's licenses, and they help communities prepare for and respond to natural disasters. And that certainly is not an exhaustive list of what we do, but it sort of gives a glimpse of the complexity of the Department of Public Safety. The governor's budget reflects our mission, so we can continue to meet our obligations to Minnesotans when they need our help. The governor's budget proposals will also allow for us to improve the way in which we provide services to meet our public safety partners' expectations and those of the people in the communities that they serve. The demand for DPS services has increased, and it's a challenge to keep up, I will admit that. For example, homicide investigations increased 63% from 2011 to 2015. And these investigations require significantly more time to complete and more time for technology evidence review. Because of the growth in the alcohol beverage industry, for example, we've seen a 90% increase in the number of licenses issued in the last 5 years. Firearms examination has almost doubled in the past 5 years, and the turnaround time will reach an unacceptable 12 months by the end of this year. The governor has proposed public safety initiatives that would address these challenges and improve our services. His proposals would increase capacity to investigate complex homicide investigations, decrease turnaround time for drug chemistry and firearms evidence processing, help communities be better prepared for oil trains that move through Minnesota, replace the predatory offender registration system, provide ongoing maintenance for computer systems such as MNLARS that local agencies and Minnesotans depend on, ensure that the State Patrol will be able to provide helicopter rescues and support to local agencies, services not provided by anybody else in the state. And although some of the proposals that I just mentioned are not in the proposals we will cover today because they don't fall under the jurisdiction of this committee, I wanted to highlight them as you will likely see or hear about them as we all work together towards the end of session. But before we can accomplish the goals that the governor has proposed, before we can accomplish the initiatives laid out in the governor's proposals, we need to address our operating budget. The governor's proposal to support ongoing DPS operations is critical just for us to maintain our current level of service to local communities and the public safety professionals that we work in partnership with. We are facing rising costs of payroll, peace officer retirement, rent, IT services, just to name a few. If DPS has to cover these increases with staff reductions or other cost-saving measures, the result will mean longer wait times for services Minnesotans depend on, increased turnaround times for evidence processing for local agencies, the turnaround turnaround time for trace amounts of suspected controlled substances now is just over 6 months. And it might mean longer wait times for driver's licenses and transactions at our Driver and Vehicle Services Division. Without this investment, DPS will be headed backward. We won't be able to keep pace with the current demand for services, and any additional resources would have to be used to maintain the status quo, not for improving the services that are expected of us. The Deputy Commissioner will cover the amount of the operation budget proposal. I understand and respect the fact that you have difficult decisions to make as you work on this budget. I thank you for your support of the work we do at our agency and also of the proposals that we are about to provide for you. And we look forward to working with you as you put together your budget. We'll be always prepared to answer any questions that you might have of us. And I'll turn it over to Deputy Commissioner O'Hara.
Go ahead. Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Cassandra O'Hearn. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Public Safety. We have a number of slides in your slide deck that you have seen before. We were here last week providing an overall budget overview. If there are any questions, we're prepared to answer, but in order to keep this moving, I will just flip through these slides very quickly. These are the base budget as well as the expenditures on both sides, the public safety and the transportation side. With respect to administrative and related services, we talked last week about the different areas and the resources that they currently have. This brings us, as the commissioner mentioned, to the governor's proposal for the operational support for the department out of the transportation accounts. You can see that they are split. We provided you the information with respect to the general fund, special revenue, the $3.31 million requested out of the trunk highway fund for fiscal 18, and then the numbers as well for fiscal 19. This investment will ensure that the Department of Public Safety can continue to provide the existing level of services. These are not increased. There is not an increase in staff in this. This is what is necessary to maintain existing level of services. The request represents known fixed costs, such as the payroll, health care rates, already negotiated contracts, rent, IT services, pension, and the like. For driver and vehicle services...
Assistant Commissioner, I'm just going to interrupt you for a second.
Yep.
Representative Petersburg has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, what is in the special revenue fund? What revenue sources does that all entail in the previous slide?
A majority of that are the driver vehicle services special revenue account. So those are the fees that are on the various different licenses, identification cards, and title and registration transactions.
If I could, Mr. Chair.
It's follow-up, Representative Petersburg.
Were any of that included with any kind of fees to the railroad department and the railroads?
Assistant Commissioner.
Not in transportation, no.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members. So driver vehicle services, the governor has proposals in two different areas under DVS. The first is the automated knowledge testing system, a core business function of driver vehicle services is to provide for the examination of those who are licensed on our various driver's licenses. This request is a request for additional spending authority in the amount of $156,000 per year that would go towards the maintenance of the new testing system. The system is 16 years old and is being replaced, but there are ongoing costs in order to keep the software, the hardware, and the system operating.
Assistant Commissioner, Representative Runbeck had a question. I may be backtracking a bit.
Sorry, backing up to, I think it was expenditures. So I just wanted to know, for fiscal 18, you had $3 million coming out of the trunk highway, and in 19, you had $8 million coming out. Is that correct? And that's a large jump. Just wondering what that is.
A majority of that relates to the state patrol with respect to the funding that was received in the last legislative session for them to have an academy every single year. So it does include the additional troopers that will be in existence as of that time, in addition to increased pension costs.
I thank you.
Thank you. Sorry. As long as we're stopped, I do have a quorum now, so I'm going to officially call today's meeting of the House Transportation Finance Committee to order. And Representative Johnson is in attendance.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Would
you care to make a motion?
I would like to move the February 23rd minutes of this committee.
Thank you. Any comments or corrections? All those in favor of approving those minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved. Thank you, Representative Johnson. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, I'll move on if we're okay on the testing system. All right. The second has to do with Governor's proposal includes $8 million per year of the biennium, which would be collected through a proposed $1 transaction fee. This transaction fee would be used to support the ongoing operation and maintenance costs of the new MNLARS system. Last week we talked about MNLARS, and the system is coming, and parts of it are already in existence. Shortly, the motor vehicle part of it will be in operation. As these parts are stood up and active, we need to be able to maintain and operate them, as well as then once the driver's license comes on in 2018 as well. Currently, the money that the department has is used for the development of the system, and this is for the ongoing operations.
Assistant Commissioner, this dollar had been dropped recently, is that correct?
So it sunsetted in June.
And so this is a new request, though. You didn't request this last year, is that correct?
Actually, there was a request for it last year.
Okay.
And
yeah, we know that's the start. Thank you.
And it didn't move forward, as a lot of other things did not either.
You don't need to remind me. So is this a temporary transaction fee? Do you look at it as temporary, or are you looking at it as a permanent fee?
At this time, it would be seen as a permanent fee. Of course, the department would be providing information around if the fee is necessary, if it could be reduced, if it could be taken away at some other point. But there does, at this point, need to be a way to maintain this system. And computer systems are continually needing maintenance and operation. That's not going to go away, and there are no funds dedicated anyplace else for that.
Representative Petersburg has a question.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just following up on Chair Torkelson's question. So I believe there's a current transaction fee already. Is that not correct?
The $1 transaction fee ended at the end of the last fiscal year. So June of 2016, that $1 fee no longer exists. There is a transaction fee on a small number of motor vehicle transactions, which has been used to support the existing legacy system.
Follow-up, Representative Petersburg.
And I think that's where I'm coming from, because I know that the old system also required a fair amount of maintenance and upkeep and so forth, and I'm wondering how that's funded and why with a newer system that should be even more streamlined, why that wouldn't be sufficient if it was handling the maintenance of the other old program, why it wouldn't be also available to maintain the new program.
Deputy Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, as I understand, there's about $3 million that come in to support that legacy system, and we would need to speak probably to Minute to fully explain the additional costs. But my understanding of what Minute has informed us is that with a new system, new technology, costs more to maintain and operate than old technology. And so that $3 million is not sufficient. It will be rolled over and used for MNLARS, but MNIT is, it has informed us that we need an additional $8 million per year in order to fully support that system when it's operational.
I'll defer to you, Chair.
Well, thank you. So why are we having two fees? Why don't we, if you're proposing it to be permanent, why aren't we rolling these together?
Mr. Chair?
Assistant Commissioner.
That's a good question. I believe the answer to that is that they are on different transactions, but we'll get back to you on that.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Thank you. For the Office of Traffic Safety, the governor requests additional funds from Trunk Highway for the ongoing maintenance of another computer system, this one being the new MnCrash system. Under current statute, the department is required to publish a summary of crash records and to analyze that information for public safety purposes. The MnCrash system compiles and provides this information. It is necessary to support this system as well in its maintenance and operation in the amount of $470,000 per year.
Yes, and Deputy Commissioner, so this is another charge to the Trunk Highway Fund, is that correct?
This one would be a charge to the Trunk Highway Fund. The MNLARS $1 fee is a fee on a transaction and is not a charge to the Trunk Highway Fund.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, the final request that the governor proposes for divisions under the Department of Public Safety is the State Patrol helicopter request. We talked about this last week, and this is split between the general fund and the Trunk Highway Fund. The total request is $5.75 million. It's a one-time amount request for fiscal 18.
Representative Barr has a question.
Thank you. On the prior slide, so maybe others know what it's for, but what do you actually do with the crash information? It's great to publish it and have it on a website, but what are we doing with that? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Deputy Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, and I do have the director here who could speak more fully if my general answer doesn't fully answer the question. But the information is used by a variety of different stakeholders, including the Department of Transportation, the State Patrol, other law enforcement entities, emergency responders, the Department of Health, in order to really try to determine why crashes are occurring in different locations and to provide that information to support policy decisions.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we're on to the helicopter. I know we're moving quickly today. Do we have any further questions? Otherwise, we stand for questions and are happy to provide any information at any time.
Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had some question really about the Office of Traffic Safety. There, I believe in your department you have an office, and then there is a second office, the Office of Safety Technology, and that's in MnDOT. Is that correct? So I just wanted to know, it seems that, I mean, I think we're spending $13 million in the Office of Traffic Safety, and it's largely education, things like that, but maybe you could explain more exactly what we are doing in the Office of Traffic Safety. And is any of it supported by federal money?
Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Donna Berger. I'm the director of the Office of Traffic Safety with the Department of Public Safety. The Office of Traffic Safety gets currently $470,000 of Trunk Highway money a year from state funds. The majority of our funds come from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration through grants to address driving, safe driving, promote seatbelt use, impaired driving, distracted driving, motorcycle safety, child passenger safety. there is an Office of Traffic Safety and Technology that is housed in MnDOT, and they work on road safety engineering improvements, and they are a partner in the TZD program, but a separate entity, and the money, I can't speak to the money that they get.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you very much. I think that's good.
Okay.
I know it wasn't on your part of your presentation, but I'm curious about the pipeline safety account. Does anybody, and it gets a little cloudy because I think the probably technically the Department of Transportation, but yet your department benefits from that account, I believe.
Mr. Chair, are you talking about the rail and pipeline safety assessment?
Yes, I am.
So the Department of Public Safety does receive an appropriation of $2.5 million per year, and that is set to sunset at the end of this fiscal year. And in the governor's proposals, he has requested that sunset to be lifted and an assessment to the railroads of $1.5 million per year, so $3 million for the biennium, to continue the work that we already do with the Department of Public Safety through our Homeland Security and Emergency Management Division. We provide training across the state to first responders, especially along the rail lines, to help them prepare for an incident that might happen in a pipeline, along a pipeline or along a rail line.
Thank you. Do you have a balance in that account today?
Mr. Chair and members, I don't have today's balance. I would say it's roughly around $6 million.
And the annual collections are about $3 million? I forget what the number was.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Currently, the assessment, the collection is $2.5 million per year.
Million, and you have $6 million in the account.
Correct.
Thank you. I believe I would like to hear from the railroads at this point. Representative Lucero has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question for the commissioner in regards to the helicopter. When I'm reading the line item here, one-time appropriation to purchase and equip the Bell 407 helicopter. Does that include equipment related to the Kingfish or Stingray, the cell phone, man in the middle to capture texting or voice on the helicopter?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lucero, no, it does not.
Thank you. I'm just trying to dig into this railroad situation a little bit more deeply, and I know Mr. Sweeney's about to retire, so I want to give him every opportunity to appear before the committee because any one of these might be your last chance. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Brian Sweeney with BNSF Railway Company in St. Paul, and I keep hoping it's my last chance. The rail industry is adamantly opposed to removing the sunset. That was part of a package that was negotiated 3 years ago, which placed a number of responsibilities on the rail industry, including doing training of our own, making that available to all local responders up and down our lines. We have fulfilled our parts of the bargain. We have provided the plans. We have participated in the training. The agreement was for a three-year payment into the fund with a sunset after 3 years. We figured that was the deal that was made and that it should be adhered to.
Well, thank you, Mr. Sweeney. Representative Hornstein, to this point.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. It's more of a comment. I certainly understand the Chair's concerns and the rail and pipeline industry's concerns with this. But, you know, these issues are ongoing. They're not, they don't just come and go. We have pipeline and rail safety issues. And I would just, you know, hopefully we'll, I know you have a bill, Mr. Chair, I'll have a bill similar to yours introduced soon on just a whole range of rail safety issues. And, you know, one idea that I would throw out as a possible compromise, and I understand your point, Mr. Chair, there's $6 million, why should we continue to add that? But, you know, maybe we do a blink on, blink off this, you know, if the fund gets drained down to a certain level, then we do an assessment again. And we're talking about such a minuscule amount of money compared to the profits that these railroad and pipeline companies are making right now. And in the interest of safety, this money, and I think DPS can tell you, has gone to train many, many first responders. The first responders appreciate it. And, you know, given the fact that you know, this is going to be an ongoing issue. I think that, you know, maybe instead of getting rid of this entirely, you know, we could put in some language that would address your concerns and the industry's concerns.
Thank you, Representative. You know, I'm a strong believer in when you come to an agreement, you stick to your agreement, and there's some evidence here that the governor's trying to change the agreement unilaterally, and I just don't think that's the way to work around here. Any further comments from you, Mr. Sweeney?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just again say that we have done an extraordinary number of training with local emergency responders. We have broadened it. We have provided quite a deal of information to them. We send emergency responders to schools, special school dealing with oil train safety in Pueblo, Colorado, at our expense. I would also point out that when this package first passed 3 years ago, it was with the prediction that the number of oil trains was only going to increase. At that time, there were about 9 or 10 a day going through the Twin Cities, and the projection was that would just keep on growing. In fact, the number is less than half of what it was back then, and when the Dakota Access Pipeline project is completed, that number is only going to go down. So the exposure that was contemplated when this package was put together just has not materialized.
Thank you, Mr. Sweeney. Tell us a little bit about your safety record here in Minnesota.
I don't have the state's specific statistics. However, overall, the rail safety injuries and accidents both have gone down by a rate of 80% over the since 1981, and I would point out that that's the year I started with the industry. But there's been a dramatic improvement just since 2000. I believe it's something like 40% reduction in the rate at which injuries and accidents both occur. The number of grade crossing accidents has also gone down very sharply over the years.
Thank you. So, Mr. Sweeney, what is your last day?
Technically March 31st.
So we have another month to tap into your vast knowledge.
I'm not sure I'd use that adjective, but yes.
Thank you, Mr. Sweeney. Representative Hornstein, a follow-up.
I'll pass on my comment. I thought about it and withdrew it from public.
I think I appreciate that. I'm not sure why. Thank you, Mr. Sweeney. Other questions for the department at this point regarding, I'm not seeing any, Commissioner, but I'm just looking around. Anyone else that... from the public that has any comments on the department's budget? Do you have some wrap-up comments, Commissioner, that you'd like to make?
Not necessarily, Mr. Chair, other than thank you for your time. I know you have a busy agenda, and we'll be happy to answer any questions as you move forward or as you think about or contemplate moving forward.
How's Minlars today?
Better than yesterday.
I'm going to keep asking, you know that. So keep that moving forward. That is really of critical importance, and you know that.
We'll do that.
Well, thank you for your expedient presentation. I do appreciate it. We're going to move on to bills, ladies and gentlemen. We'll start with the Petersburg bill. President Anderson, I've asked her to come back at a quarter to. So House File 1352. Representative Petersburg, would you care to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House File 1352 be re-referred to the Committee on Taxes.
Representative Petersburg, I have an amendment for your bill. Would you like to add that now, or you want to do a presentation first?
Mr. Chair, let's add it right now.
All right, I will move the A1 amendment to House File 1352 to put the bill in the shape that the chair would like. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed by the same sign. Amendment bill is amended. I believe we have a testifier to the amendment, but why don't we go through the bill first?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Huff said that he would be here as a resource if you need him, but he could also bypass his testimony for the sake of time as well. So that would be up to you, Mr. Chair. Basically, this bill indicates an ongoing change in how aviation does business, and one of them is that they've developed an engine that actually can use automotive gas. And it's called auto vehicle gas, and so it's oftentimes referred to as AVGAS. But because there is no other exemption or refund available, it currently pays the same excise tax for gasoline as vehicles that are driving on the road. Obviously, we hope none of the planes are flying down and landing on the road, so they're not using actually the roads that are designed for this excise tax. Basically, what this bill does is it allows them to get a refund for the difference between what the current gas tax price is for Minnesota and the 5 cents that is already being collected for normal aviation fuel. And that nickel then goes to the airport's programs, et cetera. And so basically, wherever it talks about aviation fuel, it is also adding in alternative fuels that can be used in place of auto aviation fuel. And basically, in a nutshell, that's what it does.
Thank you. At this time, I'm going to ask Mr. Klavan to come forward and describe the details of the A1 amendment that we've added to this bill. Please identify yourself for the record.
Hey, Mr. Chair. For the record, Bruce Klavan. I represent the Minnesota Agricultural Aircraft Association, the spray plane folks. And Representative Fiesenberg did a good job explaining. We're looking for the same outcome here in terms of the graduated basis. This was part of the tax bill, both his language and the amendment as a package last year. Ours, we amended in the Senate in 2015, and of course that did not become law. So this is essentially a do-over for both his original language and ours. It would just add the spray planes to the list of graduated basis payers.
Thank you, Mr. Klavan. I don't see any questions for you. Why don't we have Mr. Huff step forward? We have a little ahead of schedule, and as long as we have a chance to thoroughly analyze the bill, we'll do that. Mr. Huff, would you just care to make any comments from your perspective on the bill?
My name is Gordon Huff, Executive Director of the Minnesota Business Aviation Association. Piston aircraft are switching over. In 2020, the aviation gas or aviation fuel 100 low lead will hopefully disappear, and planes will then start using the what we call auto gas or MO gas, because they can burn the high octane if they modify their engines, and consequently, that this bill will make sure that that nickel goes into the state airport fund, and when the pilots could apply for the refund, they weren't doing that, and so we were losing our nickel all the time, and this will give us that nickel back. Also, guarding the future, if the new gas, which we believe will be an automobile derivative, there will be no argument that it's automobile gas. It should go to the state highway fund. If it's used at an airplane, it will go into the state airport fund.
Very good. I do not see any other questions. Question from Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering about what happens at these smaller airports. You know, we're switching the funding from one mechanism or one gas product to another. You're going to need extra pumps and tanks at these airports. You know, these small rural airports going to be able to afford to make that switch?
Mr. Huff.
I'm not an expert on if the fuel is going to be compatible with the existing tanks, but that certainly would be the goal, is that they would not need to add new tanks. They may need to add some a different hose or something, but I'm hoping, and I can look into it, but we do not anticipate that they would have to replace the tanks. They would probably have to clean them out, but replacing them, we're hoping that that will not be the case.
Thank you. Representative Petersburg, would you care to renew your motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I renew my motion to re-refer House File 1352 to Committee on Taxes. Excuse me. Committee on Taxes.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg.
As amended.
As amendment. Thank you. Thank you, Mr.
Very good. Good catch there, Representative Nelson. We try to run a tight ship. And you're helping. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Representative Petersburg, you're on to taxes. You have another bill, Representative Petersburg?
Mr. Chair, yes, I do. I will make motion and move that House File 1336 be re-referred to the Committee on Taxes.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg. Please go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this bill is very similar to the other. Again, it talks about equipment and engines that are being used and using gasoline that are not part of a fleet that is actually being and running on the roads. And it is such things as the refrigeration units on top of refrigeration trailers. It is also for trucks that are not licensed for on the road but be moving around trailers in a distribution center, etc., that are never going to be on the road. And again, this, again, like the other previous bill, is a refund of those taxes. And the process is in place right now. We just want to make sure that it covers the areas that are currently are not on the road, and therefore the taxes are not would not be necessary in order to fund any kind of damage or use of the roads. And with that, I believe I do have a testifier that would like to see a few comments.
Thank you. Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead.
Yes, good afternoon, Mr. Chair. My name is John Hauslodden, President of the Minnesota Trucking Association. Staff is passing out two handouts, a Minnesota Department of Revenue form, which I'll reference, and then a document that has three photos that gives examples of the kind of devices that Representative Petersburg is discussing. The Minnesota Trucking Association represents 675 trucking companies and their allied vendors across the state, and I am here to testify today in support of House File 1336. And like one of the earlier bills, this is a do-over from last session. The House did include it in its tax bill. It didn't make it into the final bill, but we appreciated that support, so we are back. And again, we thank Representative Petersburg for his work. House File 1336 is a bill that brings equity to the tax treatment of diesel fuel used off-highway by trucking companies by exempting them from Minnesota's sales and use tax. Trucking companies use off-highway diesel to operate a number of items, refrigeration units or reefers that keeps food cold, power takeoff units or PTOs that run pumps to empty bulk tanks, and auxiliary power units or APUs that power a truck driver's sleeper cab needs. And you will see examples of these on the handout provided to the committee there. In Minnesota, other major industries, including agriculture, forestry, and mining, are exempt from paying sales and use tax on off-highway diesel. House File 1336 simply grants a similar exemption to the trucking industry for diesel used in off-highway applications like those mentioned. It is important to stress that we're talking about diesel that is used for off-highway purposes. It is not used to propel the truck down the road. So if you take a look at the photo, and the very bottom one would be a refrigeration unit where you have a power unit, trailer, you have a reefer on the front, a separate tank for the reefer fuel. And you can't quite see it, but under the cowling in the front is where the saddle tanks are located. In fact, the picture of the truck on top, you can see those saddle tanks very clearly. So when a refrigerated carrier, like the one in the photo, fuels its trucks, they actually fuel three tanks. The two saddle tanks, one on each side, which fuel the truck's main engine, and then any auxiliary power units or PTOs, and then a separate refrigeration tank, which fuels that reefer unit, all from the same retail fueling station. So after fueling, they pay one bill that includes the state fuel tax on all of the gallons purchased for those three tanks. Minnesota then allows them to request a refund of the state fuel tax for the fuel that they use to operate the refrigeration units and auxiliary power units. And they do this by completing the PDR-1 PTO, or commonly referred to as the PTO worksheet, which you have right there. However, after applying for a rebate of the state's fuel tax, they are then liable to pay a sales and use tax on those same off-highway diesel gallons for which they just received a rebate. The retail sales and use tax, which is what we are talking about here, is designed primarily to tax property and sometimes services when they are sold to the ultimate consumer.
to tax business inputs, such as fuel purchased by a trucking company for off-highway purposes, goes against this fundamental purpose of the sales and use tax. Essentially, taxing business inputs like off-highway diesel leads to the pyramiding of tax liabilities and burdens Minnesota's overall economy when the tax gets passed on until it reaches the ultimate consumer. This effect is especially hard on Minnesota manufacturers and wholesalers because they may bear a greater tax burden than may be the case for products made elsewhere and imported into Minnesota. So as stated earlier, other key industries like agriculture, forestry, and mining have received exemptions from the sales and use tax for off-highway diesel, and it is our desire to be treated like those other industries and be explicitly exempted from the sales and use tax of off-highway diesel. We believe doing so is equitable and good tax policy. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. I believe Representative Hornstein is going to ask you something about the size of the drivers that operate these trucks.
No, but that's a good question. No, thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Haslott, and maybe it's for you or maybe even Mr. Lee, but what is the revenue impact of this bill approximately? I mean, clearly there's some impacts for your industry, so you must have a ballpark figure.
Right. There's not a formal...
Mr. Haslott.
Mr. Chair, there's formal. There's not a formal fiscal note, but when we did this last session, it was about 1.3 per year. Million.
Okay.
Mr. Haslott, so per year. That was a revenue note in the tax committee?
It was not a it was comments from the revenue department when we were preparing our testimony, but the fiscal note that they prepared last session didn't actually have a formal number in it.
Thank you, Representative Hornstein.
No, thank you. That's what I was interested in, the number, approximately.
And everybody's smiling, so I think we're in good shape there. Other comments or questions? Seeing none, thank you for your presentation. Representative Petersburg, you care to renew your motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I renew my motion to refer House File 1336 to the Committee on Taxes.
Thank you. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Dissension in the ranks. We are going to move on to my bill, House File 1617.
Formerly known as bonding.
Mr. Chair, would you like to introduce your bill?
And thank
would
you, Mr. Chair.
Move it, please.
I'd like to move House File 1617 be referred to the Capital Investment Committee.
Please go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you. House File 1617 deals with our local bridge grant fund. In the past, there have been incidences where there have been some local bridges that have cost tens of millions of dollars, most of them, of course, here in the metro area. When one of those bridges gets funded out of the local bridge funding program, it takes so much of the revenue out of the program that there's not much left for those local bridges that it was originally intended for, that in my mind it was originally intended for. We typically only have one or two of those bridges in a biennium, those what we fondly call budget-busting bridges, and it's my opinion that those bridges should come, those very large bridges should come forward as individual projects. So the purpose of this bill, we first talked about it last year, is to put a cap on the size of any one bridge that would be funded by the local bridge replacement program, and we've set that in this bill at $7 million.
And Mr. Chair, I know that we have a few amendments here, but we also have quite a few testifiers. Would you like us to just deal with the testifiers first and then get to the amendments?
I think it'd be helpful, Mr. Chair, if we did the testifiers first.
Okay.
That may enlighten us as we proceed with amendments later.
First on my list, I have Don Elwood. If you would come down and begin his testimony. And then I have Bev Ferrer. Ferrer.
Are you together?
Please identify yourself and who you represent, and you may proceed with the testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon. My name is Don Elwood. I'm the Director of Transportation Engineering and Design for the City of Minneapolis. My group is responsible for the roads and bridges in the City of Minneapolis.
Go ahead.
Thanks for your time today. A handout's going around right now for the 10th Avenue Bridge. This is a bridge over the Mississippi River right in between downtown Minneapolis and the University of Minnesota. The 10th Avenue Southeast Bridge is a historic open spandrel concrete arch bridge. It was constructed in 1929 and is listed on the National Historic Register of Places. The bridge is an important river crossing. Over 10,000 vehicles a day cross that bridge, and over 2,000 pedestrians and bicycles use that facility each day. In addition to serving the local river crossing, the bridge provides a vital link between two job generators, the University of Minnesota and downtown Minneapolis. This bridge becomes even more critical as the region grows and more investment in the area occurs. The bridge for future use and future capacity is a priority. When I look at the economics of 10th, we did a cost benefit for that bridge, and that cost benefit came back that a rehab was the best alternative to use for that bridge. Our do-nothing approach would eventually result in total closure of that structure and the ultimate removal of that structure, which in today's dollars is pegged at about $21.5 million for removal. A new bridge constructed in today's dollars is at about $125 million. There are very few bridges of this size and magnitude that are on the local municipal system. In recent years, there have been several bridges that have needed repair or replacement, and these are all reaching the end of their useful life. Funding for these bridges is complex. They're complex to develop. Typically, we try to find multiple sources of funds. Each of those funding sources have different timelines associated with them and or different rules, and to pull a funding package together for rehab or replacement is very difficult. Flexibility and help is needed at the state level to help get bridges like this funded and into a program. Clearly, the need for 10th exists. This bridge is unique in that it's on the municipal system. It's unique in size and in magnitude. I think I'm consistent with my engineering colleagues across the state that is calling for more funding for local bridges and that flexibility. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Let's move on to the next testifier. Please identify yourself and who you represent and continue on with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Beverly Ferrer, and I'm the operations manager for the City of St. Paul. Thank you for your time today. I am here today to share concerns we have with the House File 1617. The City of St. Paul is not in favor of going to a $7 million is identified, $3 million through the amendment maximum cap for state bridge bonds, because we will not be able to fund some of our major bridge projects in St. Paul if that happens. Case in point is our Kellogg 3rd Street Bridge. First, I'll quickly share some history with the regard to the Kellogg 3rd Street Bridge. For context, in 1982, MnDOT built the 3rd Street Kellogg Bridge because at that time it was designated as Trunk Highway 5. It was a trunk highway identified and designed by the state. In 1983, the state turned the Kellogg 3rd Street Bridge back to the City of St. Paul. Had the city known at that time that eventually the state bridge bond funding used for rehab or reconstruction of the bridge would be reduced, we would have strongly possibly reconsidered the turn back because of the nature of the problem we would be eventually having. This bridge spans over 2,000 feet in length and crosses over I-94 and the Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railroad. We knew then, as we know now, that this is an expensive bridge to replace and that state bridge bonds are a significant part of the funding strategy. In brief, the Kellogg Third Street Bridge provides a connection from the east side of St. Paul and the neighborhoods there into downtown St. Paul. It also provides regional access into downtown from westbound I-94 traffic. The bridge has proven to be a critical artery for the city, its residents, businesses, and visitors. This bridge carries, in most recent counts, 9,900 vehicles per day. It provides direct access to traffic coming in from the east to access downtown St. Paul. It also serves as a connection from one of St. Paul's concentrated areas of poverty to jobs downtown. In September of 2014, the Kellogg Third Street Bridge was found to be structurally deficient to handle the vehicular traffic load. Since that time, the city has taken the following steps to ensure that the bridge and travelers are safe. We've reduced the four-lane vehicular bridge section to a three-lane vehicular section. We've narrowed the sidewalk access on the south side of the bridge from 10 feet to 6 feet. We took all vehicular load off the outside cantilevers of the bridge, and the center portion of the bridge is therefore able to support the current vehicular and pedestrian load. The bridge needs to be reconstructed, and as we as a local government cannot afford to fund this expense on our own, we do need state bridge bonding to help fund the bridge replacement. Reconstructing the bridge will allow us to develop a cross-section that will return the capacity of the bridge and as well as providing multimodal transportation elements to the bridge, sidewalks, bike facilities, and allow us to prepare for future mass transit use. We recognize the cost of this bridge is significantly more than other bridges currently in the queue. The high cost of reconstructing this bridge is driven primarily by its length, very long length. We also understand earmarking bridge projects in the bonding bill has been met with strong resistance over concerns of transparency and fairness. Given this resistance to earmarking, we feel that if this bill becomes law, we would be unable to fund and reconstruct major bridge crossings, particularly in the cities of St. Paul and Minneapolis. Therefore, we ask the legislature to leave the agency with all available tools and resources to make the most efficient decisions on funding road and bridge projects. Thank you for your time. I'll stand for questions.
Thank you, testifiers. And I just a quick question for you. Seems like both of these projects would extensively use up any particular year's worth of dollars in the bridge fund. What alternatives do you see as moving forward and getting projects like this done when we take the entire allotment of dollars away from the local road and bridge fund to use on only one bridge? Either one of you have a comment?
Mr. Chair, if I understand the question, it gets to the allocation of the existing bridge bond program,
mm-hmm, right?
Of using all the money for maybe one or two structures. And I don't know if I have a direct answer for you on that. I have said that we need more bridge funding across the board. But if we put our local bridges in with all the other local bridges, then that they are qualifying no different than others. If we can find a different way to fund those bridges, then I think we'd be open to that as well. We are trying to find funding for these bridges, whether that be from the federal level or others, and we have been unsuccessful.
Thank you for that. I'm just looking at, you know, how do we get around the idea that it gets used up oftentimes in larger projects. And this could happen anywhere in the state, whether it's Mississippi River down southeast or Minnesota River down the middle of the state. Some of those larger bridges just take up more of the dollars. And I think this bill is one of those that are attempting to try to give additional dollars through bridges and trying to understand the complexities of the metropolitan area. And where I also understand that your reluctance to go for earmarks, but in projects of this scope, in the bonding bills, it seems that that is also relevant, at least, to be considered as part of the criteria. So if you have any other comments on that, otherwise we'll move on to some other questions.
Local bridges versus federal?
Yes. Mr. Chair, I would share that the cities of St. Paul and Minneapolis have a little bit different challenge than some of the very legitimate and significant challenges that communities across the state have. They have a variety of bridge needs, but most of the larger bridges, all of the larger bridges in those community are trunk highways and have a completely different funding source. So we have a little bit different playing field, and therefore we have different challenges. And if we don't pursue earmarking funds, we need to have some other source to get to a level playing field, and this appears to be our only opportunity at this time.
All right, thank you. I think Representative Hornstein has a question. Well,
thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Ms. Fairhair, is it? You answered my question. I was going to ask what are the consequences if House File 1617 is passed, and I think you articulated that you'd be actually directly unable to fund and reconstruct these two particular bridges, and I just want to make sure that I heard you right, that basically these projects would not happen if this bill were to be passed.
Ms. Fairhair?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I appreciate your point, and I did answer that. You're correct. It would be a long time before the city would be able to find a funding package to fund the bridge. We do not have a vision right now of what that would be, but we know it would be a very long time.
And I guess that would be helpful to hear Mr. Usna's perspective as well on the 10th Avenue Bridge, since that's in my city.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Thank you for bringing that point up. Yes, because it's a local bridge, I'm limited on the availability of funding. So if there is less flexibility in the bridge program, then I have less flexibility on how to fund this bridge. So it would be make it more challenging than it already is to get this bridge built.
Follow-up, Representative Hornstein.
Mr. Chair, I think we have a new verse that we can tell Bruce Springsteen to write about his song 10th Avenue Freeze Out, because that's exactly what's going to happen if this if this bill is passed.
Thank you. I believe Representative Salk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In pursuing a bit the same thinking, and I suspect you don't have a inventory of bridges across the state would be in the same category.
Either testifier?
Mr. Chair, I can share. For a very short period of time, I was the state bridge engineer, and so I did see a lot of the state construction. And I know up in Duluth, the bridges up in Duluth are going to need work in my lifetime time period. And that, again, is going to be at the state level. To the best of our knowledge, there have been very few bridges of this size across the state and would not crop up very often, if that answers your question, sir.
Representative Saul?
Yeah, it does. But I think what we're doing is we're setting a demarcation of value as opposed to just size and that sort of thing. So at this particular point, without the amendment, we're saying $7 million. So we're talking about that group of bridges in the state that are not, as you said conveniently, that, they are trunk highway bridges, so they have other pathways. So how big is this for the whole state? Because we're an aggregate viewer. We're not a specific viewer in the sense that your presentation. I understand why you present the way you do. But I'm interested in is what's our aggregate picture here? And you do have at least a perspective from that from your past employment, and maybe both of you through your associations have a sense of this. So right now the demarcation is 7 million or greater across the state. How many units, and do we need a funding system that identifies that group of bridges so that then we are stepping up as a state to address the funding? Because I will tell you, across the state, the number of dollars that are going to come are coming from one pot, the state's pot. Whether it's your bridge, or Duluth's bridge, or Rochester's bridge, or you get my point. Yeah. It doesn't matter. That's a big chunk of money that's going to weigh on the state's budget.
Do either one of the testifiers?
Mr. Chair, thank you. I know that with talking with my colleagues across the state of Minnesota, transportation funding is a big issue for all of us. As engineers, we try to figure out how to maintain this infrastructure and how to make the funding work, and it is a challenge, no question about it. So I know in Duluth and at other cities, they are facing some similar problems as we are in Minneapolis.
Representative Sal?
Just one more thing, then. So are we creating an orphan class of our bridges?
Mr. Chair?
Go ahead.
Yes.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to either one of the testifiers, included in the testimony, there was a reference to multimodal transportation. So I'm just curious, with this particular bridge, is there any plans to run any trains or any other multimodal purposes on this bridge?
Either testifier.
Mr. Chair, thank you for your question. Yes, there is. There are plans for multimodal access for the Kellogg Third Street Bridge. That would be bicycles, pedestrians, and mass transit. At this time, we don't have any plans for LRT on that bridge, but a lot of planning is yet to be accomplished, a lot of discussion, a lot of finding out what the right things are to do. With the reconstruct of the bridge, there would be a gateway trail connection there. That is our desire.
Representative Lucero? No. Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the challenge that with the earmarks. I think a lot of us are very wary of earmarks, and I can see where this presents a challenge to you folks with respect to the expensive bridges. I hope you appreciate that for a long time in the rural Minnesota, the large bridges have eaten up bundles of projects of small bridges. But I think it was addressed to some degree last year, in the Senate's transportation bill. I believe there was a program, a major local bridges account established. Have you looked at that, where there would be a separate, just like this is what Representative Perkelson is seeking to establish, is a fundamentally a local bridges account, but to separate out those so they get their due. Have you looked at, again, seeking a major bridges account?
Either testifier have a comment?
Mr. Chair, I do not. I cannot speak to that. I regret.
Mr. Elwood? Representative Johnson? That's the last of the questions that I have. So let's go on to the next two testifiers, Steve Novak and Dan Larson. Thank you for your testimony. We appreciate it. Thank you to the committee. Welcome to the committee, gentlemen, and if you could identify yourself and who you represent and continue on with the testimony.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Steve Novak. I'm with the Minnesota Inter-County Association, handle transportation issues. We're here today to support Chairman's bill, House File 1617. Essentially, his bill has been the same as a platform plank on our platform for transportation for the past 2 years. The only difference is we set the dollar limit at $5 million. I think the only other thing I would add to this is that I believe that by the passage of his bill, we add an element of transparency to this whole subject that has not been here in the past. I'll just reference the last time we passed a bonding bill that had a major transportation component. I think we thought we had $70 or $80 million for bridges around the state. But then when we looked inside of it, of course, there were two major mega bridges, and there was maybe $15 or $20 million left for the rest of the state to do bridge projects. And I think that these bridge projects that have been discussed that have oftentimes been in Minneapolis and St. Paul actually stand on their own merits, and that we should not be concerned. I think that in a normal debate across the state, fixing these kinds of bridges in Minneapolis and St. Paul will hold up very well on their own and get the deserved money that they should get to be fixed, but to be separate from the overall bridge fund around the state that ends up involving dozens, if not hundreds, of individual smaller bridge projects that are very important to those parts of the state. So we support the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Novak. And I understand from your testimony that originally you were talking about $5 million, but you'd be willing to accept $7 million, right?
Yes, sir.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Larson, would you please identify yourself?
Mr. Chairman, members, Dan Larson, Minnesota Rural Counties, 30 rural counties across the state, greater Minnesota, here today to support House File 1617. We thought it was a good idea last year, and we're back to say we think it's a good idea again this year. So appreciate Representative Parkinson bringing the issue forward. And we see this. We have a similar policy as the MICA group does, still at that $5 million, but yes, Mr. Chair, we would accept $7 million. We see this provision, this bill, as protecting the integrity of the fund. I think Representative Johnson alluded to the fact that too often over the course of the last decade or so, you've seen an adequate number of dollars appropriated through bonding, only to find out when you, upon closer inspection, that there's that there's some major projects that were earmarked in those bills, leaving much less for the approximately 2,000 bridges that are identified as deficient or obsolete across the rest of the state. So we do support this bill, and we thank Representative Torkelson for bringing it forward.
Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Often when we're writing a bonding bill, when we have something that everyone in the state needs, we do like to put it under an umbrella because it looks, you know, it's going everywhere. The dilemma is as soon as you name one, then that one becomes a target for any part of the state who doesn't want to fund, whose taxpayers don't want to fund something in that other part of the state. And so it's sort of a practical reason we do this. There's movement to have fairly significant amounts now in that local road and local bridge dollar amount. What I show here is the master bridge priority replacement, that the average bridge cost is $395,000, some as low as $50,000. So if we start to put in $70 million or $80 million or $90 million, you could build one heck of a lot of $50,000 bridges. And what I'm struggling with is how we provide equity for all taxpayers. I heard the Minneapolis gentleman talk about a cost-benefit. They had to do a cost-benefit when you spend that much money. You know, maybe I'd come with a bill that says we will do a cost-benefit for every one of those $50,000 bridges and see whether it's worth all taxpayers in the state building that culvert. That's, I think, the thing that those of us who represent the areas that have the big bridges struggle with. How are you fair to all regions of the state and all taxpayers? It seems so easy to take all the responsibility for the small bridges in Greater Minnesota, and we just struggle with how we get to a point of equity.
Do either one of the testifiers like to take that question?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would say, if, with all due respect, the representative sort of defined the problem in reverse, which is that by the nature of how this state has constructed itself over 150 years, we've got over half the state's population in seven metro counties. Therefore, when you have a major bridge project in Minneapolis or St. Paul inside a mix of all of the bridge projects around the state, and you apply one standard to it through the Department of Transportation, which has a lot to do with travel counts and so forth, it's going to be very difficult for an important bridge in the southeastern part of the state, the southwestern part of the state, the northwestern part of the state, to compete with those kind of numbers, because there's no place else in Minnesota that gets that kind of traffic. And so I think that's part of the frustration. I share your frustration in terms of trying to find an equitable way to approach this, but I think, speaking for county engineers that I represent anyway, their frustration has been that it's just hard to compete with a mega bridge in the metropolitan area when you're inside one pot with one set of rules that applies across the state and has car counts, or whatever the appropriate term is, as a big part of the measurement of how you get to the top of the list.
Mr. Larson, do you have any additional comment?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's a fascinating question because it all depends. And Mr. Novak brought up the question, how do you compare a major bridge project in Minnesota with thousands of average daily traffic counts to a $5,000 bridge in central Minnesota or southeast Minnesota that nobody drives over except for in the spring or in the fall when two or three major farm operations that have to use that small bridge to get those crops to that market efficiently. So within, it's all, So within that region, that bridge is very important to the local economy. So how do you compare one to the other? I'm not sure, but it's important to that region and to the overall state economy, or to the economy of that region, and ultimately to the ag economy of the state.
And, Mr. Chair, if I could just follow up, maybe it'll be helpful. I think we had it actually at an earlier meeting, just to see how many of those local bridges have been done in the last, I think it's quite a few, as I recall seeing that list, and maybe it's helpful to be reminded of that. When the original, you know, people like Bernie Leader were at the table and they wrote some of those initial formulas, I think there was a lot of time and effort. Everyone came to the table to figure out how can we write some formulas that are fair to everyone. And I guess my hope would be that some of you who are involved on a regular basis on these really difficult questions might sit around a table in the interim and look at this one and say, is there a way to write one bill that's fair to everyone? Unfortunately, with this bill, we sort of go after one type of project to the benefit of everybody else. And what I always wish that those of you who are experts in the area would spend some time around a table and come to us with a solution that works for everyone, and maybe that would be an interim assignment.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
Representative. I can tell you that we have a lot of those kind of meetings amongst ourselves. What would delight us is if we had more meetings with you folks about these subjects, because I think that would be helpful in terms of maybe finding a common solution that would work for the state.
We do need to keep moving. I have two more people questions, and then we're going to cut off, get to amendments, because there may be more questions there. First, Representative Nelson, and then Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is more of a comment than a question, but this is a symptom of a much larger problem that we've been having in this state for many years. We're underfunding our bridge, our road and bridge instruction. We have $6 billion backlog, and this is just an idea of, is two different groups fighting over the crumbs that are left, and with the solution isn't, I think, to take money from one or the other, but try and come up with a way to get new money into transportation and move forward to deal with the $6 billion backlog.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to echo that, and it's my thought exactly. As county after county has passed the sales tax to try to get at partly the bridge issue, but I do come back to the concept of a major bridge program and a smaller bridge program. There was a major bridge program in legislation last time, and it kind of reminds me of what I see happening with the corridors of commerce, where there's in 2013, I think we wisely said half of this funding is going to go to the metropolitan area, and half is going to go to rural Minnesota. And that may not be the best way to do it, but it recognizes these differences. We have inherent differences in criteria as to what to choose and what to build in rural Minnesota compared to urban Minnesota. And that's our reality. And so not only do we need the funding, Representative Nelson, but we need to figure out some ways to at least try some mechanisms to get at those disparities, and maybe a major bridge and a minor bridge account, a local bridge account demarcation, there's a way to get at that.
Thank you for your comments, and thank you for the testifiers for testifying today. And we'll move on to the amendments, I think. Chair Torkelson, is A1 amendment kind of a more of a technical amendment? Should we do that one first?
Yes, it is. And
should we have Matt first?
I believe it's just a technical amendment to put the bill in the shape I would like it to be. I don't have any further comments myself.
Mr. Burris, do you have just a brief analysis of it?
Mr. Chair and members, the A1 amendment makes a couple of technical and clarifying changes. It removes, in Section 1, removes some language around cross-reference that was to a repealed subdivision from a number of years ago. So that's a little bit of cleanup. And then the other sections centralize and clarify that the requirements for the local bridge replacement and rehabilitation program that are established in a couple of different subdivisions would apply to each of the types of grants that are authorized under this section.
Are there any questions about the A1 amendment? If not, all in favor of amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. On to the next amendment. And I believe Representative Johnson is offering that.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the amendment. And this gets to a series of conversations I had with a retired county engineer in my region. And he basically said, you know, if you had it at $3 million, that would capture really the local bridges that we're talking about. So I had this drafted at that level. I then hear the testimony from the last two gentlemen where their organizations have had said $5 million, and my neighbor and friend said, reminded me that was what those organizations suggested. $5 million is between seven. I don't know if there's a way between seven and three. Perhaps we could do an oral amendment and just make this delete $7 million and insert $5 million would be the appropriate number for that.
So if I understand, Representative Johnson, your amendment actually is $5 million instead of $3 million. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, if you allow that small change and recognizing the testimony we heard earlier, I think it's a good idea, yeah.
With that change, Representative Torkelson, do you have any comments?
Thank you, Representative Johnson, Mr. Chair. I don't know quite what to say. We're accomplishing the same thing with either of these dollar amounts. The dollar amount is somewhat arbitrary. You have to pick a level for something like this. I was at $5 million last year. I raised it to $7 this year based on some information I had that it might do a little better job of including the scope of bridges that's out there. Perhaps you have other evidence that 5 is a better number. I think we're splitting hairs here, frankly, even though $2 million is a lot of money. In my bank account, it's not so much in the general bridge fund.
Representative Johnson?
Given that, I'll withdraw my amendment.
Okay, Representative Johnson has withdrawn his amendment. Are there any other discussions or any other people that would like to testify in favor or against House File 1617? Hearing none, Representative Torkelson, would you like to renew your motion?
Mr. Chair, I renew my motion that House File 617, as amended, be referred to the Capital Investment Committee.
Representative Torkelson renews his motion.
1617, I think I misspoke.
That House File 1617, as amended, be referred to Capital Investment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Moving on. What's that?
It's a resume.
Representative Anderson. Next we have before us Representative Anderson's bill, House File 257. We're going to hear this to be laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr.
Welcome to committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, this is a familiar issue with you. It is asking that we provide for a retired law enforcement special license plate. In the state of Minnesota, we have several special license plates that we offer to different entities, anything ranging from firefighters to college special license plates. And I do have a list of those. And surprisingly, though we do provide one for retired firefighters, we do not provide one for retired law enforcement. This issue was brought to me by a constituent in my district, and I would just ask for your support. And that is all that I have to offer at this time, Mr. Chair. I stand for questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Representative Anderson? I see none. We will... Chair Anderson, can you help me? You know, I don't chair these.
Do you have any other? I don't have any testifiers. I don't know if anybody from the audience
right,
wishes to testify.
Right. Do I have to vote on a bill that gets laid over for possible inclusion?
No, you don't.
I didn't think so. Thank you for your.
You just put it in your omnibus bill. That's all you got
to
do.
I'm so glad you're here to help me today. With that, if there's no questions, Representative Anderson, we will move on to the Nash bill. Thank you, Representative, for being with us today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
This is only our second try.
Next, we have House File 800, Representative Nash.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair.
What's the motion? This bill is also being heard to be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Representative Nash, please go ahead with your.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, for those that were in regional governance transportation, you've heard this before, but it's essentially very simple and more of a philosophical bill. It says essentially if the state didn't pay for the build-out of a light rail, the state is not on the hook for maintenance and operations moving forward. And I use an analogy in that committee that I'll use again. I had a neighbor who wanted to do a fence project. And I talked to them that I wasn't really down for the fence project because I didn't like the idea of a fence. And they went to the trouble of setting it back off of the property line so it wasn't shared because they knew that I didn't want to pay for the maintenance and operations of it because whether you like it or not, if it's on the property line, you're going to be paying for some sort of maintenance. Same idea here. Specifically, and we'll just name it, it's the Southwest Light Rail Project that was really... The legislature of the last 2 years did not fund that. It was sent to various counties who have used certificates of participation, and that's where they are going to be funding this project for the build-out. And as a subsequent result, my argument is that the state should not be paying for the maintenance and operation. Very simple, very straightforward. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Nash. Representative Hornstein, you're first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Excuse me. You mentioned this is affecting the current Southwest light rail. There is a current lawsuit affecting this. And if that lawsuit is successful, it really deals with the routing decision that the Met Council made. Now, the neighbors are arguing that it was... premature decision and alternatives weren't considered. And if the lawsuit is successful, one might think that there would be at least another option considered through Uptown or Nicollet Avenue for Southwest Light Rail from Lake Street downtown. Would your bill also impact a potential reroute of the Southwest Light Rail?
Representative Chair and Representative Hornstein, I've actually never gotten to say this before. I'm not a lawyer. I don't play one on television, and I wouldn't want to comment on a pending lawsuit, not knowing the outcome of that. So I really couldn't say. But
okay, well, Mr. Chair, it kind of relates to then my second question, which is, then you had again mentioned Southwest. It sounds like it would potentially affect a rerouted Southwest. It would affect Botno, and it would affect a possible line in the East Metro that's also being considered in St. Paul. Is that correct? If I'm reading your bill correctly, would it affect basically? Would it essentially be a moratorium on all state operating funding, or a ban on all state operating funding for any light rail line, current or pending?
Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hornstein, if you read the language, it says that if current lines that currently do receive maintenance and operations fund, Mr. Burrs, feel free to jump in and correct me, as I know you will. This is that if there's an additional extension, that only then will those be covered. This bill does not currently affect ones that are in existence, that was my legislative intent.
Mr. Burrs, would you care to clarify?
Mr. Chair and members, yes, as Representative Nash noted, the way the restriction is laid out is that it would only apply to lines where they're not already in revenue operations currently or extensions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Nash. So I'm clear on that, but I guess what I'd be interested to know is that this would affect then a possible rerouted Southwest line, Botno, and East Metro line. I just want to make sure. So we're talking about anything that has not been constructed would be affected by this. Is that correct?
Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hornstein, again, with the provision that it's not built with, or it's built without state appropriated funds. So in this particular example, as we all know, Southwest was not built or is not being proposed to be built with state appropriated funds. Subsequently, that's the gist of the bill.
So, I can't comment on future funding mechanisms, and you know that future legislatures could go ahead and change this. So I can't really speak to what it will do to future projects.
Okay, and one last question.
Hard to.
So it sounds like it will affect all of those projects that I mentioned. You're not going after commuter rail, is that correct? Any operating expenses for commuter rail in this bill?
Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair, no.
And also bus rapid transit would not be.
Representative Hornstein.
Mr. Chair, no.
Nash.
Okay.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It seems like we have a little bit of a moving target. We've had some bills that seem to want to impede all transit going through this committee. Some want to impede just light rail. Some may want to impede light rail, but sometimes do, in fact, impede arterial bus rapid transit, commuter rail. So I just wanted to get clarity on what is covered and what is not covered in this bill.
Mr. Chair and Representative Horsey, you've heard me say dozens of times that I'm not interested in impeding bus. You know that I like buses. So I'm very happy to continue talking about buses.
Good.
But as it specifically relates to this, and you heard me say this all last year when we were in committee together, ultimately the Southwest isn't being built with state-appropriated funds. And I think from a philosophical perspective and from a what should we reasonably expect of our taxpayers perspective, that if we didn't build it, then people across the state shouldn't have to pay for it. And that's the gist of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hornstein. Representative Nash, the term ban was used. Would you describe this as ban on state funding?
Mr. Chair, no.
I would not either. I believe that it just would require legislative action. If a legislature in the future chose to fund operating costs of a line that was built, no matter how it was built, the legislature could make that choice. I interpret this bill as saying that we are not going to allow people to assume that the state is going to be liable for paying the operating costs of projects that it has had no voice in authorizing the construction of.
I recognize that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hornstein. We have a question from Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Nash, on lines 1.11 through 1.13, specifies that light rail projects is for a portion of project capital costs. Southwest has had state funding, not total, but some. I've carried a $30 million bill to do design and research. So how would that affect Southwest?
Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenthal, I'll again defer to Mr. Burris.
Mr. Burris.
Since I'm not a lawyer and, again, don't want to play one on TV.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenthal, so the test that's being established there requires that the law would have to be enacted on or after the effective date of this section. So it would, in effect, not provide for operating costs of the Southwest Light Rail because it would be looking forward to a law enacted by the legislature at some point after this provision went into effect. So it wouldn't be pulling in any past appropriations that have been made for Southwest.
Thank you, Mr. Burris, but those lines that have been built and completed are not affected, is that correct?
Mr. Chair, yes. Any line that's up in revenue operations would not be subject to this limitation.
Thank you. I just want to make that clear. A follow-up, Representative Rosenthal?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Nash. So I was in your committee earlier, so if this was already asked or commented upon, forgive me. You know, Southwest runs through my community, so businesses support it. The Chamber of Commerce supports it. United Healthcare has built a station for it just because of they anticipate the growth along that corridor. And, you know, roads actually are funded, you know, they don't pay for themselves. So it really bothers me the distinction we make between light rail, buses, and roads and bridges. They're all subsidized by the state, and they all should get some recognition.
Thank you. I did not hear a question there. We have a question from Representative Mason.
Thank you. Representative Nash, is there a reason that you believe that this particular rail doesn't have state funding?
Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mason, you know, as I'd said previously, it was very clear what the
the legislature decided to do the last 2 years. The counties decided to go around the legislature, and that's really the problem that I'm trying to address.
Right, and the legislature last year didn't get out a bonding bill. They didn't get out a transportation bill. I just want to, I cannot tell you how frustrated I am. MnDOT is 20 years behind in projects. We've got all of these. We should be moving forward, and this project, according to one of the our members that worked on it, has been worked on for 12 years. We are stopping stuff from going forward instead of moving ahead. Minnesota is losing time, and this to me is just an awful piece of legislation. That's my personal opinion.
I didn't hear a question in there either, Representative.
No, Mason. There's no question.
Perhaps you should talk to the Senate, Representative Mason. We may want to hear from the Met Council. I see he's anxiously awaiting his chance to talk to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Judd Shetton. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Metropolitan Council, and thanks for the opportunity to speak on House File 800. We heard this bill in the Transportation Policy Committee as well, and the concern that the council has related to this bill is when we move forward with preparing our application to our federal partners on this, who are paying half of the cost for this project, we have to provide an outlay of the operations plan for this project. And what we have done is we are in the process of fulfilling that right now. And in our plan, it shows that current law says the state must pay 50% of the operating costs for this project. And so what happens is if this bill were to move forward, we don't have an agreement with the feds on where those funds will come from. And so we understand, I understand what Representative Nash is saying. However, we operate under current law. And that law does say that 50% of the operating funds, after you take fares off the top, is split between the Met Council and CTIP. And right now, that is what our application is going to look like. I'm also wanting to clarify a few things related to the project. The legislature, the Minnesota legislature, did pass funding for the Southwest Line in the 2009 session, the 2011 session, and the 2013 session. There was also discussion related to the general funds that were made available in 2013 with the legislature acting on rescinding some of those dollars. But some of those dollars were used, some of those general fund dollars were used, and they came back to the council, a lot of those funds, and the council then took motor vehicle sales tax reserves and put those back into the project. So all in all, when you look at what the state has put toward this project, it's a total of about $37.5 million. And we are at the point now where two weeks ago today, we put out the civil construction package for this line. And that this is a $700 million civil construction package that is going to go out. We anticipate 7,500 jobs are going to come along with this project. We anticipate a state payroll. The payroll for this project is going to be between $350 and $400 million. And this question came up in the Senate, and I wanted to share it with the House as well, is the question was asked on the Central Corridor project, how many of those jobs, there were 5,500 jobs that were created by Central Corridor, how many of those jobs were from Minnesotans? And 90% of those jobs were from folks who live in the state of Minnesota. And they came from 60 of the 87 counties, and the suppliers and contractors came from over 30 of the 87 counties in the state. So what this bill would do, particular to Southwest Transit, is really put the brakes on our ability to be able to tell our federal partners that we have a funding plan in place for the to receive the full funding grant agreement for this project. So that is very troublesome. On a much smaller scale, the state has put in $1 million toward the Bottineau line. It's not much, but the fact is the state did provide $1 million worth of bonding for the Bottineau line. I believe that was in 2013. But my point, Mr. Chair, is what you don't see in the fiscal note is there being an impact in this fiscal year or the next one. However, the impact that occurs is when we make our application to the federal government this year. And so since we won't be operating the line, it doesn't show that there's a problem. But the fact is that there is a major problem with how we move forward with this project, because it has an immediate issue when we make that request for a full funding grant agreement. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Shetman. So at what point in the process do you have to verify this operation funding stream to the federal government?
Mr. Chair and members, we have the these conversations with our federal partners as we move through the different phases of engineering and preliminary engineering. When the council takes the project over at the beginning of the preliminary engineering, which was about 4 years ago, we have to have it in place when we submit our budget, our full funding grant agreement request, which we anticipate will happen at the early June. And, Mr. Chair, one point I'd like to add, because I think that members may be thinking, well, Med Council, you're saying that you'd like to use the sales tax in order to pay for the operations of this line, and that is true. We have a sales tax request that we're bringing forward. The fact is that we can point to the state or to our federal partners that if that sales tax takes place, then we actually have the funding, and we can point to that as that is going to occur. We can't do that based on this bill, because you are saying that another local entity will have to pay for it, and we can't compel them to pay more than the 50%. So we are in a bind.
Thank you, Mr. Shetman. So the early June date is in reference to Southwest Light Rail.
Mr. Chair, members, yes, that is our anticipated timeline. Early summer, I don't want to put a specific timeline on there, but it is in the early summer. We do know, we'd like to, we anticipate that those bids will come in sometime in May, and that hopefully we'll have the full funding grant agreement in place, and we'll be able to move right into construction by later this summer. Late August, September.
Thank you, Mr. Shetman. So then how about the Botno line? At what point in the planning for that line will you be at the point where you need to verify operational funding?
Mr. Chair and members, we are probably about 6 months to a year behind that line. What we don't have in place for the Botno line is the full state share for that project like we do for the Southwest project. That is the difference. The operations, we have the capital side set for Southwest. The operations are set between the state statute that says the state's going to pay 50%. But the difference between this and Botno is that we don't have the capital dollars in place for Botno at this point. So we're not to that point of it being an issue when we submit our full funding grant agreement.
Thank you. And I've heard before that Botno's more or less 9 months behind Southwest Light Rail. Is that still a current situation? I realize it's an estimate.
Yep, Mr. Chair, members, it is. Again, the difference is that we have the capital share in place for Southwest. We don't for Botany.
Thank you. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier. So I recall the events last year when there was the Botany bill was being negotiated, and there was agreement between the House and the Senate leadership and the governor's office, and then it did pass the full House, and the bonding bill went over the Senate, and they broke their word and tried to do an amendment and tried to reverse that last minute and fell apart. But then after that, I can remember the headlines throughout the summer of seeing to the effect that they're moving forward full speed, at least the appearance was, trying to put RFPs out for contracts and do another step. And I'm thinking to myself, it's pretty clear that there's some question in terms of the funding, the capital, and the operational funding of Southwest Light Rail going into the future. And then when we're seeing this legislature come into session and we're having these very conversations with bills such as Representative Nash's, and then I'm hearing you speak about you're still in conversations with the government, the federal government, and having to demonstrate the 50% contribution from the state, et cetera, wouldn't it be wise then at this point, since there are a lot of question marks, to perhaps put the brakes on some of this and stop with the appearance anyway of trying to move the ball down the court as much as possible, as fast as possible?
Mr. Shetland, do you have a care to comment?
Mr. Chair and Representative Lucero, I think some of your comments were making a point. I think that the decision related to moving forward with the project and the governor saying to the council to move ahead with the certificates of participation was the governor's decision. I think it's important to recognize that the state's share of this project is about 10% of the overall project cost, and all of the other funding was in place. And I think it's fair to say there's a difference of opinion amongst all the people who were involved in the end of session discussions last year as to what the agreement was going to be or what the agreement was. And there was a lot of work that occurred between the end of session and heading into this session as to how things were going to be resolved. However, we were in a position where we needed to move forward with the project because if we weren't able to show that the state share was in hand, we wouldn't be able to move forward with the different engineering work that had to be done. And when you delay that type of work, that project starts taking on delays that cost in the millions of dollar range. What we're talking about is this project is $1.8 billion. A delay of a year would cost this project about $50 million just because of delay. And so the decision was made by the governor to say go ahead and do that. Because, again, as I said earlier, the state share of this project is about 10% of that. And actually right now it's less than that because the we're waiting to see if we can work something out with the legislature to move forward with this. Otherwise, the governor mentioned that he would move forward with certificates of participation or, depending on what happens with the dissolution of the county's transit improvement board, there's been discussions about Hennepin County taking over those costs. So either way I look at it, I think the state is getting a very good deal in this process because, again, I mentioned earlier the jobs created, the work that is being done, how we the state is going to put in these funds, but then we also collect income tax and sales tax off of the payroll that is coming through, that I would say this is a good decision for the state to move forward with.
Mr. Shetman, you brought up the cost of delay. Do you have any idea what the cost of delay is for all those projects that were in last year's bonding bill that were torpedoed by your transit efforts that were very poorly orchestrated?
Mr. Chair and members, I'm just going to let you make your point.
Thank you.
I'll let our policymakers respond to that.
And by the way, that proposal was never brought to the Capital Investment Chair. I never saw it in print. It was never a formal proposal, yet it was allowed to torpedo what I believe was a very fine bonding bill. I'm going to leave it there before I say something I shouldn't. Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I have two questions. One is, has there been any, for cost overruns of the project, I wondered if there's been discussion about who's responsible for those. And secondly, what is the status of negotiations with TC&W, or TW&C, I don't know, regarding liability?
Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck, I apologize. I missed part of your first question. The second part of your question is those discussions are happening as we speak. They are ongoing.
The other question, Mr. Chair.
With TC&W, Twin Cities and Western Railroad.
Representative Runbeck.
The other portion was about cost overruns. I mean, assuming, because most of these major projects have several hundred million in cost overruns, who picks those up?
Mr. Shetman.
Mr. Chair and members, the projects of this size are required by the federal government to carry a large contingency fund. And right now, as part of this project, I think close to 25% to 30% of the overall budget is for contingency.
Mr. Chair, of the 1.8, Mr. Shetland?
Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck, that's correct.
All right, thank you.
Representative Johnson, you pass. With that, ladies and gentlemen, we are adjourned.